So, just two more lectures and we're done. We're nearly there, nearly on the home straight. So, obviously, I'm not going to cover the whole of the Luther story today, but I did want to at least bring you through 1518, maybe 1519, where much of the foundation of Luther's later thinking has been laid down. For those of you who are going to be here for the rest of the week, we're going to be looking at some of the texts I'm going to touch on today. We're going to look at those in more detail over the next few days. One of the important aspects of the Lutheran Reformation that's often neglected is the artistic aspect. In Wittenberg, Luther was close friends with a painter called Lucas Cranach, and Cranach really created, in some ways, the public image of Luther through his paintings. And it's interesting tracing the differing faces of Luther as Cranach paints him over the years. Cranach also painted Katie Luther, Luther's wife, from 1525. She notoriously apparently complained that he never quite made her as beautiful as she really was. That's inherently unlikely because often your payment as an artist depended upon you creating a good impression for the person who was meant to be paying your way. But Luther knew the importance of image. One of my favorite Cranach paintings, I think it's post-Luther's death. It's a painting from 1547, and it's Luther preaching. And it's a long, narrow painting. And on the one side, you have Luther's family gathered in a little group with a few other figures. And I think one of the little girls in the family has a scarf on that covers the lower part of her face, and that's a convention for indicating that person was dead when the event was supposed to be taking place. It was a way of putting the whole family together, even though they'd been separated by death. And then over on the other side is Luther standing in a pulpit, and his one hand is placed upon the Bible, and his other hand is extended like this, pointing a finger. And there in the middle of the painting is Christ hanging on the cross. And the painting really communicates beautifully what Luther understood preaching to be. Preaching was essentially pointing people to God as he'd revealed himself in the crucified Christ. It's a dramatic pictorial representation of an important part of Christian ministry, as far as Luther was concerned. And one of the things I want to emphasize just before we go back to the narrative is, do not underestimate the importance of the flesh of Christ for Luther. For him, God manifest in the flesh was vitally important. Kind of goes back to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier on when I talked about voluntarism and how voluntarism pointed away from human expectations about God to how God had revealed himself to be. Revelation. And for Luther, God revealed himself supremely towards us in the flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ. It's one of the reasons why if you go to a Lutheran church, particularly if you were to go to a Lutheran church in a place like Scandinavia, where Lutheranism was a dominant religion for many generations, the churches often look quite Catholic when you go in, certainly from a Protestant perspective. You walk into a Lutheran church and there are crucifixes around. And that's somewhat jarring, I think, when you come from a Reform background and you have strong opinions about the representation of Christ. It can be a bit jarring, but it makes sense within the Lutheran context because for Luther, what a crucifix does is reminds you of how small God made himself in human flesh. And this is, it's a vital aspect of Luther's thinking. He'll make comments such as, you know, do not give me God without giving me his humanity. For Luther, God demonstrates himself to be merciful in the human flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ. So the incarnation and representations of the incarnation are very important. And what is preaching the gospel? Preaching the gospel for Luther is pointing people to the crucified Christ because it is there that God has shown himself. We might almost say it's there that God has chosen to be gracious towards sinful human beings. And we find one of the earliest expressions of that occurs in 1518. Luther, in late 1517, he writes his explanation of the articles, of the 95 Theses. It becomes a popular tract. A complaint is made to Rome, almost certainly by Albrecht of Mainz. But the church doesn't act immediately to, say, take Luther into custody. Luther, the church in some ways, I think, has no reason to believe at this point that the problem of Luther won't be containable. And so Luther is left somewhat free at this point. And it's in April 1518 that there is a regular meeting of the chapter of the Augustinian order, the Saxon chapter of the Augustinian order. You know, if you're a Presbyterian, you're familiar with presbytery meetings that take place above the local level, meetings of church leaders, elders, ministers. The Augustinian chapter meeting would be similar to that. It would be a meeting which took place within the region, the regional body, governing body, if you like, of the Augustinian order. And it would be a time for the order to conduct, transact business. But it was also a time where there was often theological discussion. And Luther heads there in April 1518. Luther sets out from Wittenberg to Heidelberg. If you go to Heidelberg today, it still retains some of the ethos of a beautiful medieval German city. The building where the chapter meeting took place has been demolished, but there is a flagstone that says, you know, on this place in 1518, Martin Luther's theses on theology and philosophy were delivered to a gathering of the Augustinian order. Luther wants to go on foot, but I'll give you this guy's name. Frederick the Wise's secretary, a man called George Spalatin, provides him with transport and letters of safe conduct. Spalatin, one of the unsung heroes of the Reformation. If you go to the Castle Church in Wittenberg today, there is a stained glass window with Spalatin's face portrayed in it. Luther was very close to Spalatin. He was this go-between. Well, sort of slightly amusing, or I think it's an amusing story, is Luther gets married. There's some interesting aspects of his marriage. But Luther gets married, and Spalatin some years later gets married. And Luther can't go to the wedding. So he writes, in typical Luther fashion, he writes a letter to Spalatin saying he can't attend his wedding, but he's going to work out when the honeymoon night will be, and when Spalatin will be making love to his new bride, and he and Mrs. Luther will be making love at the same time to express their solidarity. It's, I would have thought remarkably off-putting for Spalatin to have that image in his mind. But anyway, Luther was a great letter writer and lacked all of the diplomatic sensitivities that civilization has cultivated in the rest of us. Luther heads to Heidelberg in April 1518. We don't know much of what went on there in terms of the business side of things, but it provides Luther with an opportunity to present his new theology in a public forum that he's not had before. And in some ways, I think it would be more appropriate to celebrate 500 years of the Reformation in April 2018 than October 2017. Because what we find in Heidelberg is Luther really does lay out a radical program for theology. October 1517, he's simply calling for clarification about a church practice. In April 1518, he lays out a radical program for theology, which one could argue in some ways he will spend the rest of his life working out in detail. The big ideas are already there. Luther himself doesn't present the theses. They're presented by a man called Leonard Beyer. But Luther writes them. And there are two sets of theses presented: philosophical theses and theological theses. And it's the theological ones that I want to reflect on for a moment today. Those of you in the class, we're going to go back and we're going to look at these in more detail tomorrow. But it's really thesis 19 and following that create the storm, the interest. I'm going to read these theses to you, and then I'll go back and I'll explain them, because the language used is somewhat arcane. Thesis 19, that person, we're told, does not deserve to be called a theologian who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened. Thesis 20, he deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering of the cross. Thesis 21. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is. And here Luther makes a distinction that will go on, will live well beyond him, become it's a very famous distinction in Lutheran thinking, between the theologian of glory and the theologian of the cross. And really what Luther's doing here is he's drawing on his medieval theological background and intensifying it in a dramatic way. Go back to thinking about voluntarism. Voluntarism, we might say, the overall impact of voluntarism was it stressed the mystery of God. We can only work out how God acts or who God is towards us by looking at how he acts and who he is towards us. We need to look at revelation. What Luther will do is take that idea and give it a moral dimension that it doesn't really have in the Middle Ages, to essentially say that correct theological thinking is directly related to the moral position of a person relative to God. Let's explore this in more detail. Let's look at the first thesis. That person does not deserve to be called a theologian who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened. What Luther's actually doing there is he's ruling out of bounds what we might now call natural theology. A theology built upon the way things are. A crude example of such today would be, well, you know, if somebody is incredibly wealthy, we might say, you know, we might draw the conclusion that, you know, that God has blessed them tremendously, that they stand in good favor with the Lord because he's given them material blessings. That's an example for Luther of wrong-headed thinking theologically. We're looking at the way things are and we're extrapolating back to God. And we might pass the beggar in the street and say, well, he must have done something really bad for God to have withdrawn all of this financial and material support from him, that he now exists in such destitution. For Luther, that's an example of wrong theological thinking. He says that person doesn't even deserve to be called a theologian who looks at the way things are. Looks at the things of God as though they're clearly perceptible in the world around us. An alternative, though, he says this. He deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering and the cross. Now, the move that Luther makes here, I think what Luther is doing is really building on Paul's thinking in 1 and 2 Corinthians, 1 and 2 Corinthians. Do you say 1 Corinthians or 1 Corinthians in Australia? 1 Corinthians, as the British do. In America, they say 1 Corinthians. Interesting that Donald Trump was mocked, I think, for saying 2 Corinthians. It's a good example of how a historical action could be interpreted in one of two ways. He was mocked greatly in America because it demonstrated his ignorance of the Bible. But his mother is a Presbyterian from the Outer Hebrides of Scotland. So she would have said 1 and 2 Corinthians. So it could be evidence that he doesn't know his Bible at all, or it could be evidence that he was very well catechized as a child by a Scotswoman. There's no way of telling beyond asking him. I have my suspicions about which it might be. But anyway. He deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering on the cross. What Luther is doing here is he's bringing the cross to center stage and giving it axiomatic significance for theological thinking. That's what Paul does in 1 Corinthians 1. You know, Paul is up again. The Corinthian epistles, I think, are wonderful. 1 Corinthians, really, Paul is defending the logic of the cross. And in 2 Corinthians, he's really defending the logic of his ministry in the light of the cross. And that's what Luther brings forward here. For Luther, the incarnation, and specifically the crucifixion, absolutely contradict human expectations of God. Luther is building on his late medieval teaching here, this idea that we can have no confidence in natural theology. But he's giving it a distinctive Christ-centered twist or Christ-centered focus. There's a reason why we can't predict the way God exists, and it's demonstrated, it's revealed to us on the cross of Christ. For Luther, the cross of Christ contradicts all human expectations about who God is and how he might act. And this is one reason why for Luther, the incarnation remains center stage in his thinking about everything. The fact that God has made himself small and manifested himself under the guise, under the cover of weakness in human flesh is absolutely critical for understanding how God has chosen to be towards people. It completely turns on its head theological vocabulary. Any husbands and wives here today? Anybody, any husband here with their wife? You, sir. I love doing this because if you hesitate, you're lost. Why did you fall in love with your wife? Oh, that's a dangerous hesitation, man. Why did you fall in love with your wife? Because why did you love her? Okay, that's a decent answer. She's beautiful. That usually works. You know, that's a good one in my experience. Yeah, have that ready. But essentially what you've done there is you pointed me to something intrinsic in your wife. The fact that she loved you was what drew out your love towards her. That's a human way of thinking about love. For Luther, the logic of the cross contradicts that. What the cross does is it turns on its head all theological vocabulary when applied to God. One of my favorite statements of Luther, and actually a friend recently, just a few weeks ago, gave it a beautiful calligraphized version of this statement over against an old print of reproduction of an old print of Heidelberg. The last thesis of the Heidelberg disputation is, the love of God does not find, but creates that which is loving to it. The love of man comes into being through that which is lovely to it. And what Luther does there is demonstrate that God's love is of a qualitatively different nature to human love. Think about how we might apply the word love to God instinctively. You know, if I want to know what God's love is like, I'm going to think of human love. I'm going to think of this gentleman over here falling in love with his wife because he saw something intrinsically lovely about her. The fact that she loved him made her intrinsically lovely to him. And then I'm going to extrapolate from that to God. And I think, well, God's love is obviously like that, works along a similar logic, is just infinitely greater. Luther would say that's a fundamental error. That's a fundamental error because you're assuming a continuity between the fallen creaturely world and the being of God. Actually, God's love is of a fundamentally different category. God's love is not reactive or responsive. God's love is creative. God's love creates that which is lovely to it. There's a sense in which one could take that single statement and say the whole of Luther's theology is just an expanded reflection upon that. We could apply it to other things. How do you think about the power of God? Well, you think about the most powerful person you know or you can think of, you know, a great general or the president of the United States or the prime minister of Australia. You're thinking of somebody who may, you know, perhaps has their finger on the nuclear button. You think of that as power. What do we mean when we think of power in those terms? we're thinking of the ability to coerce others to do our will. If I have more power than you, then I'm able to make you do things that I want you to do. The general is powerful because when he commands his battalions to move on the battlefield, they do so. We apply that to God. Well, what is God's power like? God's power is just an infinite extension of that. God is the supreme coercer. Luther would say no. No, because we have to refract our theological vocabulary through the reality of the cross. How is God's power demonstrated on the cross? Through weakness. Through submitting himself to the power of evil. Power has to be constructed in terms of weakness. And Luther would say, this is an absolute contradiction of human expectations, but it is how God has revealed himself to be. Wisdom. Take wisdom as a concept. How do we think about wisdom? Well, we think of the wisest man, the man who has grasped all the powers of logic or knowledge and is often able to use that wisdom in a way that exerts power. Luther would say, no, where do you find wisdom? You find wisdom on the cross, and the wisdom of the cross is what? It's an offense. It's an offense to Jews, and it's foolishness to Greeks. The logic of the crucified God contradicts human expectations. So Luther is constructing a theology that has got to take as almost as its starting point, if you like, the way God has revealed himself to be. And where has God revealed himself to be? And how has he revealed himself to be? For Luther, on the cross at Calvary. It's that Pauline insight that Luther picks up upon. And there are various ramifications of this. And it's interesting that we go on to Thesis 21. I'll repeat it to you again. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. Theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is. Now, what Luther does there is he's both extending and breaking with the medieval tradition at this point. Because suddenly what he does is he makes this idea of knowledge and revelation and learning about God, he makes it a moral thing. He makes it a moral category. It's not that the theologian of glory is saying something's factually correct when it's factually incorrect. No. A theologian of glory calls good evil and evil good. That reflects a moral position. So for Luther, the theologian of glory is actually a wicked person who calls evil good and good evil. A wicked person does that. A theologian of the cross, though, calls a thing what it actually is. A theologian of the cross stands in a right moral relation to the truth. So Luther takes the late medieval attempts to limit human knowledge about God and rightly focus on revelation, but he intensifies it by making this an issue of human morality as much as anything else. Our theology, if you like, reflects our morality at this point. And I think it's important that Luther uses the language, some translated as theology, but that's not what Luther says in the original text. He talks about theologians, because people do theology. Theology is not a technique that one masters. It arises out of a moral stance that one takes. And this is central to Luther's thinking. And why is it important for salvation? Well, think about it. If I want you to think well of me, what am I going to do? I'm going to make myself intrinsically attractive to you. I'm going to do good things for you. I'm going to give you gifts. I'm not going to insult you. I'm going to flatter you. I'm going to go out of my way to do things that make me intrinsically attractive to you. What is that? That's me acting as a theologian of glory. But if I think about God in those terms, I'm a theologian of glory. How do I make God favor me? Well, I do good things for him. Justification by works. I'm going to work hard to get myself into God's favor. Whereas the logic of the cross says no. No. God's love does not find, but creates that which is lovely to it. the sovereignty of God at this point, manifested in the cross, underlies Luther's emerging understanding of justification, whereby it's something that God does on our behalf, not something we do to earn the favor of God. So this is an extremely, extremely important aspect of Luther's thinking. And Luther will go on in his later theology to make the cross a mark of the church. What does he mean by that? Well, the cross, I'm going to talk about this a little bit tonight in the address I'm giving at the church. Luther makes the cross a mark of the church in outward contradiction. For Luther, is a mark of the true church. That the church should be regarded as foolish and offensive. Because that's the hallmark of the gospel as far as Luther is concerned. What Luther says here has profound, we might say, existential implications, both for individual Christians and for the church as a whole. Again, picking up on the logic, I think, of 1 and 2 Corinthians. What do we see in 2 Corinthians? I always get Luther and Paul confused. Paul is under attack because his ministry doesn't conform to the standards of success that his Corinthian critics are putting forward. And what Paul engages in 2 Corinthians, certainly in the second half of the letter, is an extended defense of the form of his ministry. And what he does there, though, is he doesn't defend his ministry for the sake of defending himself. What he does is he defends his ministry on the grounds that the things his ministry is being attacked for, its weakness and suffering, well, if you dismiss those, then what you're actually doing is dismissing the gospel. Paul is not defending himself so much as he's defending the gospel at that point. Because if you attack the form of the gospel for Paul, you're attacking the gospel itself. I think what Luther points to here is the importance of weakness in the Christian life. It's of a piece, of course, at this point in time with his theology of humility. Where does the Christian life take its cue for Luther in 1518? Despair of oneself. When are you at your strongest? When you utterly despair of your own strength, as far as Luther is concerned. And that's manifested in the cross of Christ. I think it represents a somewhat different attitude to church and Christianity that we have today. One of my favorite writers, he's actually I think he's an atheist Jewish writer. He was the editor of Sigmund Freud's papers in America, a man called Philip Reif, who wrote a very influential book, The Triumph of the Therapeutic, in 1966. It's one of those books that was more prophetic than he could possibly have known when he wrote this book about how therapy and happiness would become central parts of life in the advanced West. And he has an interesting line in that when he says, in past times, people did not go to church to be made happy. They went to church to have their misery explained to them. Love that line. They went to church to have their misery explained to them. That's Luther's theology of the cross. What is the role of the church? In some ways, it's to explain weakness. It's to explain the contradictions of this fallen world and how God, in the weakness of human flesh, has overcome those. And it also, it plays, Luther's playing with that contrast Paul makes between the outward and the inward. We judge nothing by outward, by its outward appearance. For Luther, faith, and this is where faith is going to come in, faith is going to be the means by which one penetrates through the outward phenomena to the inward reality. How is the cross power and strength? Well, ultimately the cross is power and strength because one sees it through the eyes of faith. One takes the cross on the terms that God himself has revealed, not on the terms that the world around sets for us. So Luther's theology of the cross that emerges in 1518, far more radical, I think, than what we see in 1517. 1517, he's calling for clarification of the 95 Theses. In 1518, he's doing nothing less than calling for a complete overhaul of theology at this point. That theology needs to be reset on a new foundation, and that new foundation is the crucified flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's, as I say, one of the reasons why crucifixes are so important in Lutheran churches, because for Luther, it reminded you of the small, how God had made himself small and been broken on our behalf. It's why that painting of Cranach is so, in some ways, very simple, but also very sophisticated. And it's a perfect representation of what Luther regarded the role of the preacher to be. And that was pointing to the crucified and broken Jesus Christ. And as I say, it culminates for Luther in Thesis 28. The love of God does not find, but creates that which is pleasing to it. The love of man comes into being through that which is pleasing to it. And there I think you have in embryonic form, much, not all, but much of Luther's later theology. And as I say, some people dismiss him as not being systematic, and what they're trying to say often there is he's not consistent. But I think Luther brings a consistent theology of the cross to bear on his later Christian thinking that we can see in 1518. And I think stands as an interesting corrective to much of what is done today. There is an aesthetic attached to the theology of the cross. There's a book coming out in a couple of months' time by a Lutheran scholar, Mark Mattis, in the United States on Luther's understanding of beauty. Much of it focuses on the crucified Christ. It fascinates me how, I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but in America, the aesthetics of power are so important to many churches. You see churches in the very structure, the sound, the shape, even the architecture, mimicking the structures of power of the world around. And for Luther, that would be a bizarre thing, because we're not to be taken in by the aesthetics of the world. We're to have our imaginations gripped by the aesthetics of the cross and of weakness. It's a very, very different thing. So the theology of the cross, then, theologian of the cross, a very, very important distinction, cross and glory, in Luther's theology. And something that remains very, very important to Lutherans today. And of course, it plays into Christian experience. Think of Luther's Anfechtungen. Think of his doubts and his struggles and his internal agonies. Well, how does the Lord make him strong? Through making him weak. The Lord works in a humanly paradoxical way. I often think the second thief on the cross, great example of Lutheranism in action. Lutheran, of course, long before Luther, but if you think about Luke's description of the crucifixion of Christ, it's very interesting. You know, maybe 10, 12 years ago, the Mel Gibson movie, The Crucifixion, the focus, I didn't see it, but apparently the focus was very much on the suffering of Christ in that movie. It's interesting that when you read the New Testament says almost nothing about the physical suffering of Christ on the cross. The most dramatic description of suffering of crucifixion is the Psalm 22 in the Old Testament. The New Testament focuses much more on the reaction of people around the cross. And Luke's description, I think when you have the soldiers, you have the religious authorities, and you have the first thief on the cross, all playing variations on the same theological theme. If you are the King of the Jews, come down from the cross. Think about what they're doing there. That's theology of glory for Luther. How do you demonstrate your messiahship, your kingship? You demonstrate it by powerfully overcoming the crisis that has descended upon you. The second thief on the cross, that incidentally Erasmus completely misreads. Erasmus says he's an example of minimal faith. He clearly isn't an example of minimal faith. He knows an awful lot. He knows that God's holy. He knows that he's a sinner. He knows that the first death is nothing compared to the second death. The second thief on the cross says, "What, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." That's a theologian of the cross in action. The second thief acknowledging there that the way to glory is through death. Christ will inaugurate his kingdom not by overcoming death, but by submitting to death. In fact, he will overcome death by his submission to death. That's a theologian of the cross in action. So Luther's idea, I think it really does capture something that lies at the heart of of the New Testament. And of course, by implication then, the Old Testament as well. Think how often weakness in the Old Testament is actually a means of strength, and how that culminates in the cross of the Lord Jesus Christ. So this discussion of 1518, this Heidelberg disputation, very, very important. And important as well because there was another young man there, a man called Martin Bucer. Martin Bucer was a young Dominican. He happened to be present in Heidelberg and heard Luther speak, and it changed his life. Martin Bucer will go on to be the great reformer of Strasbourg. He will be probably the single most important ecclesiological influence on John Calvin. I think Luther was a huge influence on Calvin, but we're looking at how to think about the church. Martin Bucer is the single greatest figure when it comes to John Calvin. And he was also later in exile in England and was one of the brains trust behind Thomas Cranmer in putting together the Book of Common Prayer. And his life is transformed by hearing Martin Luther in 1518. I think he gets him wrong. He thinks that Luther's having a great crack at the Pope at this point. Well, he is, but he's doing a whole lot more than that. But Martin Bucer is set down the path to Protestantism at this point, and he will go on to shape Protestantism in profound ways. Bucer, incidentally, was dug up after he died and burned at the stake here. If you visit Cambridge, where he was latterly Professor of Divinity, he dies there, I think, 1551. When Queen Mary comes to the throne a few years later, she has him dug up as a notorious heretic, burned at the stake, and thrown in the remains of him thrown into the River Cam. So he was an example of what I alluded to early on. But it's showing how Luther's impact is beginning to ripple out at this point. It's remarkable when you think that Luther is he's an unknown monk at a relatively new and unimportant university. And he is being now catapulted onto the European stage in a way that is going to not only remake theology, but also to some extent remake the way people think about society. It's stunning the speed at which Luther's reputation accelerates at this point. The church, of course, is starting to realize that Luther is more of a problem than he might otherwise have been. And rumors start to circulate that Luther is going to be subject to the ban by the church. If you're a Presbyterian, you know anything about Presbyterian church discipline, before you excommunicate somebody, there's such a thing as indefinite suspension from the Lord's table, when the person remains a member of the church but isn't allowed to take the Lord's Supper until such time as they've repented of whatever sin you're disciplining them for. The ban was the medieval equivalent of that. It didn't put you outside the church, but it did cut you off from the sacraments. So it wasn't quite excommunication. Rumors that Luther is going to be banned start to circulate. And then there's this strange incident at the monastery in Dresden. Luther is invited to dinner by a man called Jerome Empser. Empser's a bit of a case. He will go on to become one of Luther's deadliest enemies. Luther will refer to him as the goat of Leipzig. Goat having certain sexual connotations that were pretty unpleasant by and large. Luther's invited to the Augustinian monastery in Dresden. And what they do is they ply him with drink. And Luther liked to drink. He actually declared that that drunkenness, getting drunk once in a while, was one of the most pardonable sins. His last love letter to his wife asks, she was a great home brewer, beer and wine were the safest things to drink in the 16th century. Water was generally deadly. You didn't want to drink water. You wanted to drink something with alcohol in it that had been processed in some way, because that got rid of the germs. In his last love letter to his wife, he asks her to brew some of his favorite beer, because last time he drank it, he had multiple bowel movements before lunchtime. I can't imagine writing a love letter to my wife and referring to bowel movements at any point, but they were more red in tooth and claw times, I guess. But the Empser plies Luther with alcohol, and the more he drinks, And the more they probe him with questions about what he really thinks about the Pope, the more eloquent Luther becomes. And what they've done, of course, there are no recording devices in the 16th century. What they do is they have a young monk sitting behind a curtain, making a note of everything that Luther's saying, which is then sent to Rome in order to try to incriminate Luther. And so in August 1518, Luther receives a summons to Rome. And here, you know, Luther is suddenly hanging by a thread. Luther has been summoned to go to Rome. And if you go to Rome, if you've been to the Vatican, there is this great circular castle by the Vatican. And that's where troublesome clerics were put and either forgotten about or then taken out and executed. Luther receives this summons in August 1518. We will take a break there for a quarter of an hour. I think 2:45 is the... Oh, no, 2:50 is the break. We've got another 5 minutes. We can move on. The summons shakes Luther. The polemical campaign against Luther has been gaining in intensity. A man called Prierias. His Italian name, Mazzolini. Italian is, most Italian words and names end in a vowel. It's a beautiful language. My wife and I are big fans of European crime dramas, and we've come to the conclusion that in terms of just listening, Finnish is the ugliest European language, and Italian is by far the most beautiful. It's a wonderful language. It's no wonder it was the language of opera. Sylvester Mazzolini, Prierias, is appointed by the Pope to form a theological opinion on Martin Luther. And he prepares a work, a dialogue against the presumptuous conclusions of Martin Luther. And in this work, Prierias boasts that Luther is such a buffoon that he was able to refute him in just 3 days. And it's here that we get our first inkling that Luther has this preternatural grasp of how the print medium works. Because when the work arrives in Wittenberg, Luther does something very interesting. The instinct of the Roman Church at this point, with literature with which it doesn't agree, is to burn it. Ban it and burn it. Well, as anybody knows, if you grew up in Britain in the 80s, and I'm guessing it was no different in Australia, you know, if you wanted to get your record to the top of the hit parade, you simply threw a few expletives into it, because then the BBC would ban it and every teenager would go out and buy a copy. Censorship is problematic in that often it's somewhat self-defeating. Luther does not have Prierias' work banned or burned. He has it reprinted. And he has it reprinted with his own response, in which he says that it may have taken Prierias to write 3 days to write this work, but I have written my refutation of him in a mere 2. To me, it's fascinating. Not only is it's typical of Luther, because he has this very sharp sense of humor, which is as useful to him as it is at times problematic. It does get him into trouble. But it also demonstrates that he seems to have this uncanny understanding of how the print medium works. That print has its own kind of logic, and your ability to use that in a polemical situation is important. Luther also, I think, understands the notion of satire. There's a lot of satire. Luther and a lot of Luther's followers use satire to tremendously devastating effect. Some of his Catholic opponents do, but by and large, I mean, there are some pictures of Luther and Katie produced in Catholic polemical works that are remarkably sensible, and they look remarkably respectable. Luther's guys were producing cartoons and caricatures and mocking. The power of mockery and satire lay at the heart of the success of the Prince Lutheran Project, I think. Where Luther gets this from, I don't know. He's just a monk. As I say, he's a medieval man. He's a man of the Middle Ages. I was chatting with Doug Green at lunchtime. And say it's interesting how, interesting but sort of predictable that Luther's exegesis vanishes even from Lutheranism. Pretty soon after his death, he's not a guy that they look to for biblical commentaries because he's really a medieval guy. And it's the Melanchthons and the Calvins who sort of supersede him very, very easily. But one thing that he is very good at, and one thing where he is in some ways the great harbinger of the modern age, is his understanding of the print medium, how it works and how it can be used pastorally and polemically to achieve his purposes. And here, I think, in his response to Mazzolini, we get the first inkling that this person is unusual. You know, the word genius is massively overused, but there is a genius aspect to Luther in the sense of where does he get these in? They're just there. He just has this grasp of how the print medium works in a way that nothing in his training would have led you to believe that he would know it. But he knows that fonts are important. He knows that pictures are important. He knows that burning books doesn't work. He's a man of the modern age on that front. Okay, we'll take a break for 10 minutes. We'll come back. And my plans for the last lecture are we'll do half an hour. We'll get ourselves through the Leipzig disputation. And then I'll open it up for closing questions.